I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young has the day off. It's Here and Now. President Bush presented Pope John Paul II with the Medal of Freedom from America today on the president's first full day in Italy.
We appreciate the strong symbol of freedom that you have stood for, and we recognize the power of freedom to change societies and to change the world.
The Pope was a vocal opponent of the war in Iraq and told the president he wants a speedy return of Iraq's sovereignty. From Italy, Mr. Bush heads to France, where he'll meet with Jacques Chirac in Paris, before going on to ceremonies marking the 60th anniversary of D-Day. Peter Ford is covering that story for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us from Paris. Peter, welcome.
Thank you.
It sounds as if this is mostly a fence-mending visit, as well as a ceremonial one.
Yes, it's the first step in a whole month of transatlantic diplomacy, which will continue next week with the Group of Eight meeting in Georgia and then NATO summit later on, with George Bush trying to get Europe back on side.
And how's that working? How's he being received in Europe so far?
Well, in Italy, there's a fairly large demonstration planned for later this afternoon, although I think they will be kept, the demonstrators will be kept at a safe distance from him. That's certainly the case in France, where the government has ordained there shall be no demonstrations anywhere near the president, because President Chirac here also wants to make nice. He wants the D-Day celebrations to be a symbol of renewed Western unity.
Well, obviously, there are a number of ceremonial meetings, as you say, but is there also some business to accomplish, or is this mostly a chance to shake hands and say, let's let bygones be bygones?
Well, he doesn't have much business with Mr. Berlusconi, the Italian premier, because they're pretty much on the same wavelength. But in France, he is having an informal supper with Mr. Chirac tomorrow evening before going up to Normandy. And I think that's pretty significant. Remember, a few months ago, people in Washington were doubting even that Mr. Bush would come to France for the 60th anniversary of D-Day, let alone be sitting down for an informal chat with President Chirac. So I think there is going to be some business done, specifically on Iraq and its future.
And what kind of security is there around the president? Is it more than usual?
Unprecedented. There are 30,000 troops in Normandy, on top of all the gendarmes and policemen who might normally be expected. It's not just for President Bush, of course. There are 16 other world leaders at these celebrations, but it's mainly for Mr. Bush. And if you live anywhere around Normandy over the next 2 days, you're hardly going to be allowed to poke your nose out of your front door.
And what else can you tell us about the meeting with the Pope? Because this was the first face-to-face meeting between the two since the Iraq invasion, which the Pope was very much against.
Yes, and the Pope didn't mince his words either when he talked to the president. He told him, as he said in no uncertain terms, that he wants to see normalization in Iraq as soon as possible, a full return of sovereignty, and he made a point of mentioning the international community. He also made an indirect reference, but a very clear one, to what has been happening in Abu Ghraib prison, which he called a deplorable act. So he let the president know what he thought.
Thank you, Peter.
You're welcome.
Peter Ford covers Europe for the Christian Science Monitor. He joined us from Paris. Promising to find him even if he's dressed as a gypsy woman. An aide to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says messengers will track down a second member of Sharon's cabinet in order to deliver his dismissal notice in person. Sharon fired two cabinet members today who oppose his U.S.-backed plan to withdraw from the Gaza Strip. Those dismissals will give Sharon the majority he'll need when the cabinet votes on that plan Sunday. Joining us on the line from Jerusalem is Michael Matza, reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Michael, tell us, if Sharon can track down the second cabinet member, he will have the majority he needs on the cabinet, but will people accept that kind of artificial majority?
Yeah, that's the controversy. He's firing two ministers in order to get himself the majority that he needs, and this is creating a lot of havoc within his coalition and actually threatening the very essence of his coalition. It might actually, he might have to reconstitute or it might actually fall.
But Israelis, by and large, do support the withdrawal from the Gaza, don't they?
That's correct. There's something like 70% of Israel at large has supported it in polls. But what happened here is last month when Sharon unveiled this plan, he brought it to the United States and presented it to President Bush, and President Bush embraced it, actually, in many ways. And Sharon came back and presented it in a referendum just to his Likud party. it failed. And as a result, those people are saying that Sharon really shouldn't be able to bring it back again, whereas Sharon is saying, well, not true. If in a real democracy, I'm looking at the majority of the entire country, and I need to bring this thing forward. And so that's where the controversy is.
And a source close to Sharon says there's still a chance of a last-minute resolution of differences before the vote on Sunday. How likely is it that they can come up with some kind of compromise between now and then?
There's the possibility. I mean, the three very important members of the Likud, Benjamin Netanyahu, Limor Livnat, and Silvan Shalom, who's the foreign minister, have said they were going to vote against it. And Sharon has been working all week through another minister to kind of broker their votes and see if he can get them to vote for it. But at the moment, they seem to be opposed. And so there is still the possibility that at the very last minute they could vote for it and then the thing would pass with a pretty reasonable majority. But if they don't, Sharon has basically said he's going to make himself get that majority by just firing off these other two ministers.
Could there be a problem for Sharon, though, if he keeps dismissing people from his cabinet? Can he keep his government intact?
That's the problem, because if he knocks off these two National Union Party members, the National Religious Party, which is also in his coalition, has threatened to bolt the coalition. Sharon would end up with he needs at least 61 members of the 120-person Knesset, and his coalition wouldn't be big enough. There are all kinds of scenarios by which the Labor Party, which is in the opposition now, could suddenly join, or he could craft a different kind of coalition using some religious parties that would stay in and so on and so forth. But he really is this thing has really taken on the dimensions of a government crisis because you know, depending on how it unfolds, he actually could have to reconstitute his government, or he could conceivably go to the president of Israel and say he's resigning and offer the opportunity to somebody else to form a government. And if they can't form a government, then within 90 days, they would have to have new elections.
Michael, thank you.
You're welcome.
Michael Matze is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He joined us from Jerusalem. Coming up, a Catholic church in Boston resists plans by the church hierarchy to close it down. You're listening to Here and Now. The long wait is over. Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban opens today. This installment finds Harry and his friends Ron and Hermione, played again by Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, and Emma Watson, facing additional challenges in their third year at Hogwarts, the school for witches and wizards. Challenges that include a criminal who's escaped from the wizard's prison of Azkaban, new teachers, and even the train ride to school holds an unpleasant surprise.
What's going on?
Dunno. Maybe we've broken down.
Ouch, Ron, that was my foot.
There's something moving out there.
Well, joining us in the studio is Here and Now film reviewer Renee Graham. Welcome.
Hi, Gail.
So, lots of new things going on here. Catch us up. Where are we in the story?
It's the third year, as you mentioned, at Hogwarts for Harry and his pals, and it's a very interesting film. This is the third film we've had. You know, we had Sorcerer's Stone, Chamber of Secrets, and now we have this much darker film about Harry returning to school and being pursued by this escaped convict.
And darker in the sense of natural progression of story and characters, or darker just time for change?
I think it's the natural progression of the story. I mean, you know, the first film you had this, you know, you're getting to know Harry, what his story is, that sort of thing. It progresses somewhat more in Chamber of Secrets, and now we're getting much more into to Harry's background, the murder of his parents, and part of this pursuit that Harry has to try to get to know who his parents were, and through that, who he is. And there's a really lovely scene in the film where Harry is talking to this new professor, Professor Lupin, who's played by the actor David Thewlis, and he talks to Harry about his parents and how much he looks like his parents.
Your mother was there for me at a time when no one else was. Not only was she a singularly gifted witch, she was also an uncommonly kind woman. And your father, James, on the other hand, he had a certain, shall we say, talent for trouble. talent, rumor has it, he passed on to you. You're more like them than you know, Harry. In time, you'll come to see just how much.
Which has always been a theme there, but it's coming out more and more, and I think that's part of why the film has a darker tone to it.
Well, and also a new director we should take note of, Alfonso Cuarón. Surprise for some, he was the director for Y Tu Mamá También, but also did 1995's The Little Princess. There's a contrast for you. So how does he fare in the world of Hogwarts?
I think he's really elevated the Harry Potter films. He really brings out the fantasy of this. I kept thinking of The Wizard of Oz watching this film. It had that kind of a grasp. He has a really interesting way of dealing with the material, the way he deals with the kids. And I think it works because the kids are also getting older.
Deeper, richer performances?
Definitely deeper, richer performances. The film, when the film opens, Harry is being visited by this horrible aunt because he lives with this terrible aunt and uncle and there's yet one more miserable aunt to deal with. And he uses his magic on her, which he's not supposed to do as an underage wizard. And he is being pursued by this prisoner, but the prisoner, who is played by Gary Oldman, and the prisoner's name is Sirius Black, is also being pursued by these dementors, as they're called, these really terrible sort of skeletal creatures who sort of fly through and swoop down, and they're very frightening. Those are new characters, but other new character also is Professor Dumbledore. Actually, Dumbledore isn't a new character, but it's being played by Michael Gambone. In the first two films, it was played by Richard Harris, who passed away. And Michael Gambone, I think, adds a real interesting sort of wit to the character.
It is not in the nature of a dementor to be forgiving. But you know, happiness can be found even in the darkest of times. If one only remembers to turn on the light.
There's another element at work here, and that is these actors, the three main actors, are getting older. They're now 14 and 15. Are they going to be able to do this forever?
It's going to be very interesting to see how this goes on. And there's a lot of books to still make into films. And, you know, there's a possibility these characters are going to be pushing 20 by the time they get to the end of the series.
Well, darker, though, as we noted, is it still entertaining?
It's very entertaining. Visually, it's very arresting. I think there are jokes, there's humor, there are light moments, but there are some very sort of serious, heavy moments here. I think that will be somewhat of a challenge for parents in deciding whether or not they'll let their kids see this film because, as I mentioned, the dementors are very scary characters. There are some very intense fight scenes, not necessarily that bloody, but still very intense scenes that might not work for children of the age of 8.
Thanks, Renee.
Thanks, Gail.
Here and now, film critic Renee Graham reviewing Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, which opens today. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris. It's here and now. The Catholic Archdiocese of Boston announced an unprecedented number of church closings last week. 65 parishes, almost one in five, will be shut down in an effort to save money. One of them is the Sacred Heart Church in Boston's historically Italian North End. Under the plan, Sacred Heart, which now has a full-time priest, will be converted to an unstaffed chapel. But as Here and Now's Alan Cockle reports, a few North End residents have been doing some detective work. Their message to the Archbishop, you don't own this church, we do.
When we first heard this, it was like a death in the family, the fact that this possibly could close, simply because so much of our life has been involved with this church.
Ben Molinari sits in his home just two short blocks from the historic Sacred Heart Church. Molinari and his family have belonged to this church since soon after it was established in the late 1800s. But when rumors of its closing started to circulate, Ben, 58, and his younger brother Richard decided to do some research on something they'd always been told but never quite believed.
There was always this rumor in the North End that the St. Mark's Society owned the church. And we would think, this is insane. How could a church be owned by a society? Nevertheless, it went on for years and years and years, and they always reassured us that St. Mark's owned the church. Well, what we did, we It was about a week later, and I said, Richie, should we pursue this and see if St. Mark's truly owns the church? So we went over to the archives in South Boston.
Sacred Heart was established in 1884 by Italian immigrants who formed the Catholic Society of St. Mark. They raised money, bought the land, and invited the Scalabrini Order of Italy to supply a priest. It cost $3 to join the St. Mark Society then, plus annual dues of $1. Today there are 20 active members, each still paying $1 a year.
Mr. Vignola?
Armando Eddie Vignola is the Society's president.
Well, I'm 82 now. I've been there since I started serving Mass when I was 8 years old. I mean, my mother and father, I was born there. My kids are all baptized there, married there. It's part of me. It's a church for the people. It was formed at the beginning from Genoa, Piemonte, up in the top. Northern Italians. In Italy, they ran the church different. The people built the church. They ran the church. They own the church. We build it, and it's our church. But the Archbishop thinks otherwise. Everything belongs to him.
Back at the Molinari's North End apartment, Richard produces a thick sheaf of documents copied from the archives.
This is the original deed. This is when they purchased a property from the Siemens Association in 1881.
Sacred Heart sits across the square from the original home of the patriot, Paul Revere. There has been a house of worship on the site since 1649. The first Protestant churches burned in 1676 and 1770. And the present brick building with its arched windows dates to 1833, when a Siemens Bethel was established on the site. This was the home of Father Taylor, the legendary sailor preacher whose sermons drew luminaries such as Walt Whitman and Charles Dickens. Today, the waterfront is several blocks away, but then it came right to the back of the building. The fishermen slept in the basement, fixed their nets upstairs, and worshipped on the second floor. The Society of St. Mark acquired the land for the church and the rectory in three parcels. But when the Molinaris did their record search, one of the first things they found was a bill of sale, proof that one of those parcels of land had been sold to the Archdiocese.
The problem with this property is that it all goes under the number of 12 Knot Square. 12 Knot Square is the rectory.
This is Ben.
The church has no number of its own, so one could be fooled very easily if you look at all of this. When we discovered, we went to the church, to the rectory, and then actually with a ruler began measuring the front of the rectory, and the dimensions perfectly matched the dimensions on the bill of sale. So I said, Richie, it is the directory that they sold them. They didn't sell the church, thank God. And so then, of course, as we pursued the records, we discovered that the church was placed in trust with the Archdiocese for the Italian people of Boston. And the trust is still in effect today. They were only immigrants. I mean, they didn't speak English, but they wrote a damn good contract.
The Boston Archdiocese disputes whether the trust remains valid and whether the Society of St. Mark still exists. The Society members admit that their articles of incorporation did lapse for a time, but they say this was just an error and the Society has now been reincorporated. A spokesman for the Archdiocese says they will probably go to court to determine who owns the deed. The windows of Sacred Heart glow with portraits of Italian saints. It's a low-ceilinged, intimate space, and on a recent rainy weekday evening, there were about a dozen people gathered for prayers. The congregation grew to about 25 by the time the priest, in bright green vestments, arrived to say Mass. Glory to God, he said, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. The Archdiocese says there's almost no chance that a priest will remain in this church. Eddie Vignola and the Molinaris haven't given up hope that Sacred Heart will remain a church. But whatever happens, Ben vows to get the community more involved. And if it has to be a chapel, he says, then we will make sure it's the best chapel it can be.
That report from Here and Now producer Alan Cockle. As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. Next week on Here and Now, Overweight America. We check in on one state where researchers found a startling rate of childhood obesity, one that has implications for the rest of the country. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. Today, one day after the resignation of CIA Director George Tenet was announced, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said the U.S. would have stopped the terrorist attacks on 9/11 if there had been better intelligence. Surprising comments about the work of a man on the way out, from a man who at one point was thought to be on the way out, too. Questions remain about whether George Tenet jumped or was pushed from the administration because his agency missed clues about 9/11 and overstated the danger of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. On the line is David Gergen, former presidential advisor and professor of public service at Harvard University. Hello, David.
Hello, Gail.
And Richard Benveniste, former Watergate prosecutor and member of the commission investigating those September 11th attacks. Welcome, Richard.
Well, thank you very much.
You know, gentlemen, Tenet said when he stepped down that it was for personal reasons. Today, people still aren't buying it. Why not, David?
Well, because there's so many sources close to him are saying it's for more than personal reasons. Of course, in the end, I think he did. He's always wanted to leave. He's made it plain for years that he was both tired and that he wanted to get back to his family. The timing is what stunned everyone, and now with the many, many comments by those close to him saying that he accelerated his departure because of the coming of these various reports, including one by the commission on which Mr. Benveniste sits.
Richard, does that sound reasonable to you?
You know, I think people often fail to appreciate how much public servants give of their own lives, particularly in a job as stressful as the one George Tenet has occupied for the last 7 years or so. And I'm sure it's a mixed combination of being burnt out and not being able to talk about the many successes, but having to explain the failures. And there were failures and there were mistakes made, as George Tenet has acknowledged.
Hmm. And among other things, Tenet will be remembered for two memorable quotes. One was about how he had his hair on fire trying to warn the Bush administration before 9/11 that something big was about to happen, and then telling President Bush that Iraqi weapons of mass destruction were a slam dunk. Famous last words?
The slam dunk comment is, I think, going to come back to haunt for a long time. But this comment by Donald Rumsfeld today It's so surprising, but I think indicative as well of the terrible infighting that's broken out within the administration, almost a civil war that his plaguing both its policymaking, and I think that is perhaps a reason why Mr. Tenet decided he wanted to pack it in and be back with his family.
Well, and Richard, also we're told that there are at least two highly critical reports in the pipeline, one from the Senate Intelligence Committee, another from the commission that you sit on, investigating 9/11. Can you give us some notion as to the conclusions being drawn by your commission?
Well, quite clearly, there was a lot of intelligence information that had been collected with respect to 9/11 that did not make its way into the hands of those who could have taken action to protect the United States. I think it's unfair simply to put all of that on the CIA. There were many lapses in terms of communication within the FBI and between the FBI and CIA and NSA. And so on the report card for the administration agencies, where one would check works and plays well with others, we have to give a failing grade prior to 9/11.
Well, and David Gergen, since the buck has to stop somewhere, should Tenet either have been fired some time ago because of these intelligence failures, or should he have fallen on his sword voluntarily?
Well, I think it can easily be argued that he indeed has fallen on his sword here and by taking himself out. But the larger issue now is the danger the country faces in having a replacement during these critical months, a man who, while well-respected inside the agency, does not enjoy the stature or the confidence within the White House or on Capitol Hill that you want in a strong CIA director.
That's John McLaughlin you're talking about?
Yeah, John McLaughlin is will become the acting director, and by all accounts will remain there through the elections the rest of the year. I think that really weakens the administration inside. They don't have the faith in the man and in the agency that you need at a very delicate time. I think this is not a healthy place for the country to be. To lose the top CIA director and not have a strong replacement and to be going through somewhat are going to be very trying and divisive months. So it's going to be – this puts, I think, additional pressure on the president to shape his team up, stop this infighting, and to reach out in a more bipartisan way to build some sort of consensus about how we go forward here, not only in the war but in the rebuilding of the intelligence agencies.
And, Richard, to that point, if this means that the CIA is going to be in a holding pattern for some time, then clearly there won't be real reform of the intelligence agencies taking place. Can the country afford to wait?
Well, we will be making some recommendations in that regard, and frankly, I'm encouraged. In what occurred yesterday, it seems to be more or less below the radar screen because of the sensational quality of Director Tenet's resignation. But the FBI director, Bob Mueller, yesterday announced some rather transformative decisions that he has made within the FBI regarding the intelligence gathering function of the FBI for the targeting and dissemination of domestic intelligence. And it would appear that Director Mueller has gotten that message both from us and elsewhere, and is trying to do the necessary in an institution that perhaps has calcified over some number of decades.
But is that enough?
Well, it's very clear to me that this debate about how to reform intelligence is not going to stop with what Mueller did yesterday. It is the whole call for a director of central intelligence that would transcend what George Tenet's position was, bringing order into all of this. It was endorsed once again yesterday by Senator Kerry. It was called for by various newspapers. There are people up on Capitol Hill who believe that. Who is going to actually get that done and play the most constructive role in the agency? I think that's a leadership question that Mr. McLaughlin is going to have to face very, very quickly. Somebody has got to clean this up, and one man's departure is not going to solve that. As honorable as George Tenet is, and he's an honorable man, we do need serious, real leadership, and frankly, that has to come from the president more than anybody else.
Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you, Gail.
Thank you very much.
Richard Benveniste is an attorney, former Watergate prosecutor, and member of the commission investigating the September 11th attacks. David Gergen is former presidential advisor, editor-at-large at U.S. News and World Report, and professor of public service and the director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Still to come, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof about what he saw in Tiananmen Square 15 years ago. You're listening to Here and Now. This Sunday, 6 decades will have passed since the Allied invasion of Normandy.
We interrupt our program to bring you a special broadcast. The German news agency Transocean said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun. I repeat, the German news agency Transocean said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun. There was no Allied confirmation.
Thousands of veterans plan to return to the village of Sainte-Mère-Église to commemorate that anniversary, and three of them plan to enter by parachute, the same way they saw combat with the 101st Airborne Division during World War II. Richard Mandich is the youngest of the trio at age 79. He joins us on the line from San Diego, where he's been training. Welcome, Richard.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Tell us what you've been doing to train. Are you mostly practicing on the ground, or are you actually doing jumps?
Let's see. The doctor's statement and qualification jumps, those are the two main ones. They had to be physically fit to be able to do the jump.
Clearly. Well, I have to ask, why are you doing this?
Well, that's a question that always comes up. I don't know why you do it other than that you keep wanting to do as, the things you've done for a long time as long as you can.
Well, now, how are your two other parachuting friends doing? They're both 83, and I understand that one of them got a little banged up in a practice jump?
That was Fava, yeah. I dislocated his shoulder.
What does it feel like to skydive again?
When you get up there, you look out that door and you're 13,000 feet and you see things so small down below. It's a challenge. It's to go out that door and then to join up with the people you're parachuting with in the air before you pull your ripcord at 5,000 feet.
Does it make you feel like you're 19 again?
Well, in a way. It does, especially in one way, because the skydivers that I associate with, they're all younger, and just to be associating and doing things with younger people it's exhilarating and it rejuvenates a person.
I can imagine. Could you share some of your thoughts with us on this 60th anniversary of D-Day?
Well, the 60th anniversary, I guess I would have to share with the experience I had going into Holland, which was right after Normandy in September of that same year. And we flew low over the German lines. There were thousands of the planes. They had the British 6th Airborne and the 82nd Airborne, the 101st Airborne, under the generalship of General Montgomery. And our option was to split the Germans to isolate them from the sea, and our unit parachuted into Eindhoven, Holland. We were glad to get out of that plane because it was on fire and going down when we went out. And the vision I saw when I looked out across the landscape while descending was just thousands and thousands of chutes coming down and airplanes being hit and going down and hitting and dragging those chutes along with them. It was quite an experience.
It sounds as if those pictures are still very vivid in your memory.
Yeah, they are. They are. They'll never leave, I guess.
Well, good luck with your jump.
Well, thank you very much, ma'am.
Richard Mandich is the president of Return to Normandy. He and two other veterans plan to skydive into Normandy to mark the 60th anniversary of D-Day. Stay with us. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. If you're just joining us, President Bush is surrounded by unprecedented security as he tries to renew some old friendships in Europe this weekend. He's also there to mark the 60th anniversary of D-Day. Iraq's new prime minister, Iyad Allawi, said on national television today that keeping foreign troops in place after a handover of power will guarantee Iraq's security. And earlier on our program, former Watergate prosecutor and 9/11 commission member Richard Benveniste said it is unfair to pin the blame for the terrorist attacks solely on George Tenet and his CIA because none of the intelligence agencies were communicating very well.
On the report card for the administration agencies, where one would check works and plays well with others, we have to give a failing grade prior to 9/11.
The 9/11 Commission report is expected to be highly critical of intelligence lapses before the al-Qaeda attacks in the U.S. That report will be made public next month. Years ago, a massive square in the heart of Beijing, China, earned a place in the history books. Shocking reports crackled across newswires around the world as students and ordinary citizens stared down the army and the Communist Party in Tiananmen Square.
Deng Xiaoping主席做了重要讲话，他说,
"This is Radio Beijing. Please remember June 3rd, 1989. The most tragic event happened in the Chinese capital, Beijing. Thousands of people, most of them innocent civilians, were killed."
The images were indelible. A citizen armed only with his battered briefcase, staring down a column of tanks. A makeshift Lady Liberty, flimsy and idealized, warning party bosses there were alternatives to their rule. Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times witnessed those events, and he joins us now on the line from New York. Welcome, Nicholas.
Thank you.
Well, you were there. Tell us what it was like.
It was, you know, for the days in which the student movement was unfolding, it was so exhilarating. China just really seemed to be coming alive, and our friends who worked in various branches of the Communist Party or for the newspapers in China just, you know, relish this newfound freedom to actually, for example, if you were a journalist, actually write what was happening. And then martial law was declared, and there began to be the sense that this might actually really end terribly. And especially the older people tended to think that. Young people were more optimistic. And then on the night of June 3rd, there were just so many hints. The police used tear gas that day. There were announcements that people should stay home. And, you know, sure enough, that night the troops on the western edge of town opened fire and marched into the square.
And it was called a massacre, although later reports dispute the death toll. Dozens, they said, not thousands, died actually in Tiananmen itself. But the army did open fire on students and citizens all around the city, didn't it?
Yeah, there's been, I've sort of been on both sides of this. There were some initial reports that there was a massacre right in the middle of Tiananmen Square, and that was wrong. Basically, students were lying as much as the government was. But there's no question that there were, in my view, between 400 and 800 people killed and many thousands injured, which certainly makes it a massacre in my book, not within Tiananmen Square itself, not in the center of the square, but rather, you know, kind of all throughout Beijing, and especially on the Avenue of Eternal Peace, where I saw plenty of people killed, you know, and especially in the western districts of Beijing around neighborhoods like Muxidi and Liubukou, there were, lots of people killed. Some of them were students who were throwing stones at the troops. Others were just people who had the bad luck to be on their, you know, on their apartment balcony when troops were just firing wildly.
You mentioned a moment ago about what an exciting time it was. Was it something that was palpable? I mean, did people feel that change was coming, that it was inevitable, and in fact it was going to happen right now?
That's exactly what it was. There were there was a sense that people were finally being empowered. They could write their dazibao, their big character posters. They could write about history. They could reclaim history, which the Communist Party had, you know, rigidly controlled until then. They could be more open about culture. The newspapers, for about 10 days, the only time in modern Chinese history, were actually reporting what was going on. The same with television. And, you know, there were especially one day I remember in particular was April 27th, 1989, when the government had warned students not to demonstrate, had, you know, warned that they would be bloodily crushed. And the students demonstrated anyway, and hundreds of thousands of people from Beijing came out to support them. There was a small number of People's Armed Police, and the citizens just broke right through them. And there was such just a exhilaration about, you know, citizens triumphing over the regime and being able to express themselves. So just a real giddiness in the air.
Could you say, though, that it was really pro-democracy or anti-Communist Party? Because the two aren't necessarily synonymous.
It was immensely complicated, and we probably are guilty of using too much shorthand when we say just, you know, a pro-democracy movement. The main issues motivating people were they were outraged by official corruption, they were outraged by inflation, but, you know, yes, they also really did want democracy, and a lot of them had seen firsthand and had lived through the problems that arise when a government has no checks on it from the people. And they, you know, they had seen the aftermath of the Great Leap Forward, when a famine killed 27 million people because there was no freedom of information. They'd seen the Cultural Revolution. And so increasingly, as the movement went on, and especially among students and intellectuals, they really did want freedom of the press, a more representative government, and things that are fundamentally about democracy.
And you describe that time as the Communist Party may have won the battle, but they lost the war. How so?
The Communist Party, I mean, a communist dictatorship is basically a dictatorship of the left. And after that moment, then they were so illegitimate and so unpopular that they needed to do something to help win back some measure of popular support. And so what they did was to try to revive the economy. And the way you revive an economy is by creating a bit more of a market economy. And so they bolstered market incentives. They let in more and more capitalism. They encouraged foreign investment. And the result was they kind of moved to a dictatorship of the right, something more like South Korea or Taiwan traditionally it had. And as you begin to create a market economy, then that pushes out the socialist part of it more and more. And so right now in China, it seems to me it's not realistically a communist country anymore. It's a dictatorship, but it's not totalitarian. I mean, people now, they choose their own housing. They largely choose their own jobs. They make their own decisions in a way that was not true 15 years ago. And I think that the hardliners would in many cases be, you know, horrified by what is going on.
I'm sure they would. Nicholas Kristof, thanks so much for sharing your memories with us.
My pleasure.
Nicholas Kristof is a columnist for The New York Times. And this note, reports out of Beijing today say at least 16 people were detained in Tiananmen Square for trying to commemorate the uprising. In recent days, activists or relatives of those killed in 1989 have been detained or ordered to leave the city during the anniversary. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, Stefano Katsonis, and Jordana Gustafson. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Nick Weiss-Richmond. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Gail Harris. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.